Welcome to Basic Black. Some of you are joining us on our broadcast. Others are joining us on Facebook and Twitter. Hello, everybody. I'm Chris Collins, your host. Kelly Crossley has the evening off. Tonight, generational activism. We, like you, are dealing with the effects of the coronavirus pandemic and are taking precautions. We are working with a limited staff, and our guests are joining us remotely. Protests sparked by the death of George Floyd saw an outpouring of people across the world demanding an end to police-involved shootings and an end to systemic racism while COVID-19 continues. The protesters willingly took to the streets and continue to do so, voicing their outrage. But we also saw how activism has evolved with activists who are multicultural, predominantly younger, and users of social media and technology. What does activism look like today, and what are the differences and commonalities from movements in the past? And how can people involved move from protesting to effecting real, viable, visible change? Joining us tonight, Denise Warnham, a youth organizer and activist with Youth on Board, Dr. Tony Vandermeer, senior lecturer in Africana Studies at UMass Boston. Dr. Vandermeer has also been a social justice activist for over 40 years. Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson, assistant professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. And Philip Martin, senior reporter, WGBH News Center for Investigative Reporting. We welcome you all to a powerful and what I proved to be a amazing, moving show. And let's start on the campus of Wellesley College. Dr. Kelly, when you look at young people day to day, and they're actually doing something, they're moving, they're making a difference, a stand, and they're not standing alone anymore. You know, they're standing with scores and scores of people. So the courage has been backboned by legions of others. There are things that I thought I would never see in my lifetime. I never thought that Massachusetts would elect a black governor. I never thought America would elect a black president. I never thought Black Lives Matter would matter to so many different people of different ethnicities. What is your thoughts?
Yeah, this is definitely a new moment that we're living in. I think recently, back to the 4th of July, and how in my neighborhood, there were more Black Lives Matter signs than there were American flags. And that startled me because I live in a predominantly white neighborhood, and I've never seen so many signs up in my life, so many signs of solidarity. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean all my neighbors talk to me, but the signs are there, right? So in some way, you know, I think that we're seeing a lot of symbolic movements. But my concern is, are we seeing substantive movement? Are we seeing systemic movement? But I will say I have never before seen so many active, young, old, white, black, Latino, Asian people coming together in ways that I don't think any of us have witnessed in the most recent generation.
Denise, as you look at, you know, the foot's on the ground or feet on the street, what are you seeing as a young person?
I'm excited. I'm seeing more and more young people come together. I'm seeing more and more young people get angry, but for all the right reasons, and actually have support for their anger and resources for their anger. And I think it's an amazing thing, you know. Our young people, they are working hard to dismantle the social norms and disrupt what some people see as comfort. And we all know many, many great civil rights leaders were young when they started, high school, college students, you know. They shook the system, they shook the movement, and they started young.
Tony, someone who's been doing this for 40 years, how enthused and encouraged and, let's just say, happy are you with what's going on in our country today?
You know, it's what a relief it is. Yeah. You know, it's a good feeling. I'm proud of these young people. It's very important that they stay vigilant and that they also learn from what people have done in the past, not just their successes, but their mistakes, so they themselves can make new mistakes.
Philip, when you look at, you know, America today, obviously, I think we're all in agreement we have a long way to go. But over the last, let's say, 2 months, have we made significant steps forward?
I think the most significant step is seeing what folks call allies. Large numbers of people of various backgrounds, Asians, Americans, Palestinians, Jews, people of various hues, basically coming together around the notion of Black Lives Matter, basically taking that to heart and also acknowledging that Black Americans basically made it possible for many others to become Americans. Take, for example, the 1965 Immigration Act, which was made possible as a result of the civil rights movement of that period. And there's acknowledgement of that. There's been basically an effort to promulgate that information for years, but it's largely gone unnoticed. Now there is a connection. People are connecting the dots, as Tony intimated. The dots are being connected. You see this happening across the board. You saw it happening at John Lewis's funeral, where intergenerational ideas were basically advanced in his last, in the speech he wrote, or the words he wrote before he passed away. He spoke about the young people who were inspiring him, as he inspired so many crossing the Edward Pettus Bridge and running into the hands of those who hated him and sought to destroy him, who represented the worst of the institutions of this country, those sheriffs on the other side of that bridge. And so we're seeing this connectivity, and it's absolutely astounding. I saw it at Franklin Park, by the way. That was whoever, I'm sure Kelly and Denise, Tony were probably there when large numbers, about 20,000 people, marched through the park, again, of all hues, of all colors, acknowledging that Black lives matter.
Back in 1999 on Basic Black, Congressman John Lewis spoke with host Darren Duarte on his life and why he decided to join the fight for civil rights. We look back.
I saw segregation. I saw racial discrimination. I didn't like it. When I was a young child, I saw those signs that said white men, colored women. I didn't like it. I didn't like the fact that we would bus past white schools, beautiful school building, to some rundown so-called black school, or we had to go to school on broken down buses and white kids had new buses. I didn't like it. I resented the fact. And if we would go downtown to the little theater in Troy, Alabama, we would have to go upstairs to the balcony, and all the young white kids went downstairs. So I grew up resenting the system of segregation. And then I heard about Martin Luther King Jr., and that changed my life, really.
Congressman Lewis, a small man in stature, but a giant, an icon in the civil rights fight. You know, 61, he was riding. You know, 63, he was protesting. He was the youngest speaker in Washington. He was an amazing man, and we lose him about 10 days ago. But his fight and his words continue to live with us today. You know, Kelly, how powerful, how moving, and how meaningful was that, the pandemic, the coronavirus, this activism that's happening today kind of coincided with the death of Congressman Lewis?
Yeah, you know, this current moment that we've been in has been particularly difficult to lose giants, really, in the field, along with John Lewis. I'm also thinking about C.T. Vivian, who's the founder of Head Start. You know, we are in a moment where we're losing a lot of our, you know, figureheads, and it's tremendously grievous. But at the same time, I'm also really hopeful that we can take their legacy and we can build upon it, and that we can do, as Obama said at his funeral, when he was giving the eulogy, he said, let's create a new Civil Rights Voting Rights Act in honor of John Lewis. Let's make voting a national holiday. Let's make sure that everyone is automatically registered to vote. Let's do all that we can to stop voter suppression. That is what terrifies me the most about this upcoming election. I don't think it would be necessarily the numbers that vote out Trump, but his ability to allow voter suppression, to keep people from the ballot, is what I think will could possibly get him a victory. And so having, you know, the actions of John Lewis and his legacy at the forefront in this current moment, so important.
Yeah, three presidents at his service. George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and of course, President Obama gave the eulogy. And, you know, as encouraged and as enthusiastic as I am about this, let me go back to you, Denise. How does this stay front and center in our lives? How does this not get pushed to the background and say, all right, we had our moment, Black people, people of color had their time. Now it's going back to business as usual.
That just doesn't exist to me. It doesn't even sound right. It's crazy to think that there's only a time where we can matter, a time where these things are relevant, because it's our lives every single day for the rest of our lives. It is our lives to be Black. It is who we are. Actually, something that John Lewis said that I wrote down is that we may not have chosen the time, but the time has chosen us. And I think that runs real deep. And I think a lot of our young people are feeling that. Our young people are our risk takers. They put themselves out there. And I think as long as we continue to do that and keep putting ourselves out there and keep gathering our allies around us, the time's not going to stop. It's only going to grow.
Protesting, activism, the message, the word. Philip, very different today in 2020 because of social media and how quickly that message can go global. In an instant.
Absolutely, Chris. Denise, by the way, that was very inspiring. It's absolutely true. This message, as you say, global. Black Lives Matter was being echoed in Paris, France, Johannesburg, South Africa, in Hong Kong. You heard it in Australia, Melbourne. This was in East Timor. They were talking about Black Lives Matter. Places that a lot of folks might not even be familiar with on the map. This was extraordinary. And what's particularly interesting about this, Chris, is that folks are not talking just about a slogan. They're talking about the underpinnings that produce this movement, structural racism, systemic racism. To hear those two terms and people actually acknowledging it in polling, Pew, Gallup, is extraordinary. The notion that there's an acknowledgement among white Americans that structural racism is a part of the fabric of America. We always want to deify what is American without understanding that, as the 1619 Project has done so well, that this country was built on something that is not to be deified, built on slavery and institutionalized racism. Let me just say one other thing about the reach of social media. There's a new book that's coming out by Isabel Wilkerson, who is the author of The Warmth of Other Suns. It's called Cast. What she is doing and what's particularly important, and this is being talked about on social media, is that she's trying to get folks to understand what that structure and those systems are about. They're indemnified in this thing that we thought could not exist in America, racial caste. In other words, it's another way of looking at race and its underpinnings here in the United States. And young people, older people, intergenerationally, they're connecting the dots of what basically comprises the United States of America.
You know, a word that has been a hot topic, and it certainly will become a hot topic even more so as we head towards the election, the presidential election, is reparations. And reparations are something that, again, polarizing. It seems to me that because we are in a different place than we were, let's say, 6 months ago, that word isn't nearly as polarizing, and there are more people actually listening to that word as opposed to shooting it down on first mention. Tony, what are your thoughts on reparation, and what are your thoughts on activism and what younger people need to do going forward?
Well, reparations fit in the whole question of restorative justice. And it's an issue that I would say even in Massachusetts that Senator Bill Owens had put on a plate in the 70s as well. And there was large movements about that, and activists was trying to deal with it, because what reparations begin to deal with is saying now we have to repair people to the harm and the trauma that was done to them. And so activists have to keep in mind is that what is it that we're trying to do? And so part of this question, even in terms of dealing with institutional racism, is that how do we begin to change these institutions to create equity for people who are participating in these institutions. So, but reparations in many cases, in my perspective, is an act of self-determination, an act of particularly Black people saying, this is what has to happen in order to make us whole. It's not about somebody else making that determination. It's about us making that determination in terms of what we're going to do in terms of society that we're going to live in. It's not necessarily even about integrating into a society. It's about being welcoming. It's about us being able to maintain the way that we see life, how we understand culture and the practices that come with that, so that we are not being dominated by, you know, white supremacy or people telling us how we should act. We need to determine that. But there's a debt that must be paid. Dr. Martin Luther King talked about that, you know, in his last book. There's definitely a debt that needs to be paid around the trauma, the harm that Black people has faced. And just the last point, and this talks to your point about John Lewis. John Lewis was a symbol of leadership. He took initiative on behalf of shared values. Those values was our humanity. And so, but the real point is that he was in many ways, you know, more moderate than some of his fellow activists that was in SNCC. And what we're seeing now is we're seeing that energy with young people, but most important in terms of us dealing with this anti-Blackness, the world is starting to realize, number one, is that we share common ancestry. Because when we talk about who's the mother of civilization, it's Africa. And so all of us, you know, there's no one race, you know, there's no multiple races, there's one race, and it comes from Africa and people of African descent. And so we all share common ancestry, but we have to pay that debt of the destruction of Africa and the destruction of African people and the destructions of all people who've been harmed in this world.
Staying on that theme of making, you know, those of color whole, Kelly, you know, the students that you teach, let's say in their lifetime, will they ever have that feeling, or will they ever be made whole?
Gosh, I would like to say yes. My hope is to say yes. You know, I don't want to see my children marching 25, 30 years from now. I don't want to see their grandchildren marching 25, 30 years from then. I think at some point we have to have a reckoning, a real reckoning. And it does go back to reparations. You know, you cannot steal someone's bike, say sorry, and then ride off in their bike, right? Like it requires that you forfeit what you stole. And so, you know, there has to be this kind of returning of wealth to Black people. There has to be a relinquishing of power in order for that to happen. And, you know, while I'm encouraged in this moment, it has to be more than statues. It has to be more than flags. It has to be more than signs. It has to be substantive. And so, you know, I tell my students, it's very easy for you to be an activist now because it costs you nothing. You're in college, you know, it costs you nothing. But wait till you get a job. Wait till you're a homeowner. Wait till you're deciding where your child is going to go to school. And then tell me that you still believe in these, you know, ideas. And so it has to go much further, much faster than what we're even seeing right now.
I so agree, you know, because those are the things you deal with every day as a homeowner, as a father, you know, as someone who's right, who's trying to work in this community. And to me, it's just amazing that you all of a sudden you have Confederates. I mean, I grew up in Peabody. There were no Confederates. You know, I mean, you know, when I grew up, you know, the N-word, if it was said, and it was said, I mean, that certainly was no, there was no suspension. There was no, you know, calling parents home. I mean, they barely recognized it. And to be at a point now where, let's say, someone like you yourself, Denise, you know, growing up in a completely different world, but still not even close to where it needs to be, what are your thoughts, your aspirations, Denise, you know, at the young age, early 20s, that say in 20 years when you're 40, you know, when maybe you have a family of your own and maybe you have a home, you're a homeowner, what are your aspirations, your hopes at where we are in this society, in this country?
First and foremost, above everything, I am a mother. I have a 4-year-old son.
Congratulations.
And it's been crazy. It's been very emotional to raise a Black child, and especially a Black boy. And I think about that all the time, trying to figure out school systems, because I could go to Walmart and they're selling bulletproof backpacks nowadays. So it hurts. It really hurts. And it definitely kind of shakes me. Like, this is something I have to be worried about. This is something my mother was worried about. This is something my grandmother was worried about. And it kind of touches on to what Kelly was saying, like, I don't want him marching the same way that I've been hopping from state to state and being a part of rallies and movements. But I know that if he have to, he will, because that spark in our young people, that spirit, that dedication, that commitment, they have it. And like you said, you know, they're not, because they don't have all the attachments of like the jobs or the homeownership, they're willing to take that risk. And they're going to keep being willing to take that risk to put themselves in situations that not everybody can. And I also think that online helps with that a lot, too, because there are a lot of people who can't necessarily get out their houses or do everything it is that they want to. But having that online presence can cause, you know, can help raise awareness and consciousness and be get to the direct hurt of it all, really.
You know, a town or a city that hasn't always had the greatest, you know, reputation as far as race relations in Boston. And I don't know if any of you watch City on the Hill on Showtime, but it goes back to really just 1993, and it tells you of some of the police brutalities, and it's, you know, kind of based off Ralph Martin, who many of you probably know, and loosely off of Ralph's career and how he was in there fighting the good fight. And, but that was just 93, where police brutality was so prevalent, you know, in our city. And here we are in 2020, and a whole lot hasn't changed in a lot of perspectives. But, you know, there is a commission. There is people now really actively saying, okay, this is a problem. Philip, is it all lip service, or is there going to be long-term systemic change?
I think there has to be systemic change. The difference is, I don't think this, obviously no one's relying on Washington, especially the highest office, the White House, to implement that change. You're relying on some in Washington, but we're talking about grassroots movements here. We're talking about, even into the point where folks are looking to the past, where cases, let's look at just police reform, the notion of police reform. There's some of that happening on Beacon Hill, of course, but there are a lot of things missing. For example, some of the prohibitions around young people. There's still too many things allowed, many people feel, that aren't being addressed in terms of police violence against young people. In the schools, for example, school resource officers issues are still problematic. But there are also cases, I'm thinking about the D.J. Henry case, which is basically being revisited. This is a case that occurred in the past, 2010, where a young man was shot to death out of Easton, Massachusetts, shot to death in a suburb of New York. And there was no real reckoning with the police officer who did that. We're revisiting this weekend, apparently. When I say we, I'd say community leaders, the public, citizenry, revisiting the Uri Stamps case. A 68-year-old black man shot to death by a SWAT team in Framingham, Massachusetts, where there was no real reckoning. No justice. The Middlesex DA at the time decided not to even bring charges or to even look at the case in any comprehensive way. That's being revisited. So these cases are basically being revisited, looked at again, and there is efforts to basically bring justice where injustice has basically reigned. And I'll leave it at that. And I think you can see the systemic changes also, even in terms of who's been elected. People like Rachel Rollins, a progressive DA, and progressive DAs around the country who are basically looking at issues of injustice where that have reigned in the place of justice for so long.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned D.J. Henry, you know, who lives, you know, in our community and just, you know, a wonderful family. And he was a wonderful boy. And I think about that case so often because absolutely nothing was done. And if there ever was a poster child for someone who should not forget about being shot, even had a gun drawn on him. I mean, he was that guy. He was Chris Collins. I mean, he was a kid growing up in the suburbs, going to college. I mean, so for that to go to where it went and really not even a slap on the wrist, it's just, I mean, so tragic. And I'm prayful that, you know, this whole, this movement can bring cases like that to the forefront, and they will be revisited in the proper due diligence will be done and the proper outcome will come of that. All right, this is has been the end of our broadcast. You know, I'll tell you what, I promised at the beginning of the show was going to be a great show, and my guests certainly delivered. Thank you to all our guests for joining us. Stay with us as we continue our conversation on Facebook and Twitter. But before we go tonight, we want to acknowledge the passing of local civil rights activist Mimi Jones. She was 73 years old. Last year, Ms. Jones joined us at the Boston Public Library to discuss her participation in a swim-in at a Florida hotel back in 1964 that denied service to black people. During the protest, the hotel manager poured acid into the swimming pool. It was a pivotal moment during the civil rights era. Here's what she had to say about that day.
I swam to the center of the pool and then I swam back. And before I knew it, I couldn't breathe because the water was bubbling up like this in front of me. And I could barely breathe. As it turned out, he was literally pouring muriatic acid in the pool on us. And he was aiming for my face. So that iconic photo that you've probably seen, and if you Google acid in pool, Monson Motor Lodge, that young teenage girl who's screaming like this, that photo went around the world. This is poetic justice now.